because my dad had this afro going. Uh-huh. He had, you know, the afro thing going on, and Steve saw the guy, and he looked like my dad with the afro, although he didn't have the beard.
Uh-huh.
So Steve just took it upon him to, because dad was over here, took it upon himself to train him to be a wrestler, and called him the Cuban Assassin. And what Steve didn't understand is that when my dad went to Japan, he had to do TV commercials mm-hmm. in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So we own the rights and likeness to the Cuban Assassin, anything Cuban. And when I started out, I was the Cuban Commando. And you know, and that guy, I had run-ins with that guy, and I had to tell him that he can't use that name. And Steve, you know, during training, he tried to tell people he's the original Cuban Assassin for Sonic Wrestling. He's not. My dad was there in the 60s. And my dad created that character because of the Cuban Missile Crisis of, you know, John F. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
There's some more pictures here. And
cool.
Yeah. And here's a thing from up there in Canada. That's that right there is when my dad and them wrestled up in Canada in 73,
uh-huh.
Okay? And that is Irish Pat Clancy there, which he would come, you know, be a main stable here in silent wrestling in West Virginia, too. But yeah, I had to run into that guy twice. And, you know, as a matter of fact, Psycho Mike was running the show in Mullins, and a guy told me I was... Yeah, my name was on the poster, so I took my gear. I thought maybe I might have missed a booking somewhere, because that happens. And, you know, so I went down to Mullins and went inside the locker room, and Psycho Mike started apologizing to me. He had the other Cuban Assassin from wrestling back in 73 there, and the guy didn't have his gear. I had all my and he had posted a thing. This is the birth of the internet, too. And he posted a thing, one of those internet things, claiming he was original. And I had to correct him right then and there in that locker room. And I told him, legally, right now, I can sue you. And I told him, but I'm not going to right now, because I'm going to give you a chance to cease and desist. I'm telling you right now in person, you know, if you claim that again, I'm going to sue you. You know, we own the rights. Psycho Mike put me and him together in a tag team, which I had no problem, because I'm a professional. I can set aside differences to do my job. And Psycho Mike had to put me on because I owned the rights to the name. I could have sued him too. So, and I told him, I said, well, here's what we're going to do, Mike. I said, you're going to put me on the show. And since you got him here, I don't want to knock brother out of a booking. Just, you know, put us together in a tag match. Okay? We'll put the other guys over in the match. It's like, but you're going to pay me this amount of money to keep you from being sued. And I told the other guy, I'm going to let him tag with me as the Cuban Assassins, but I'm going to tell you, you can't use that name without my permission or my dad's permission. The only person that got permission to that is Fidel Sierra, which my dad gave permission to, which is the one that's the Cuban Assassin mainly known from WCW. His name is David, which is a good friend of mine and dad's too. And so I told him that, and then later on, I found out they was advertising him for Lanada in Milton, West Virginia. So I went to Milton. And I just told him, this is the last time I'm going to tell you. If you do this again, you're going to be hearing from a lawyer, and we're going to go to court, and I'm going to sue you.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you don't have any money, but you have a house. I'll sue you for your house. And that's what I told him.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't heard anything from him ever since then. So, and... you know, in Lanada, and I told her, I said, well, now you got to use me because you advertised the name, so I had to take over his bookings for her, you know, and I told her it wasn't her fault, she didn't know,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so I wrestled for her over there, and then she said, but how much I got to pay you? And I said, listen, Lanada, you just give me gas money, you know, you didn't know, you're caught in between, this guy already was warned, and I'm telling him again, I'm going to sue him for his house. So he's never come out or done anything ever since then. But I have to keep an eye out so I have to put myself out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where Gary gets it confused between the Cuban Assassins. But what Gary doesn't understand is that there's a lot of big name wrestlers that know my dad, that knows me, that also that I was their part of their beginning. Like he brought in David Hart Smith or British Bulldog Jr., David Boy Smith's son. and his name is Harry, which I know Harry from Stampede Wrestling. And when he come down, he asked Gary Dameron about me because they know I'm from West Virginia. Leap and Lanny Poffo come in, asked him about me because very good friends with me and my dad. And then Rene Dupree, which is Emile Dupree's son, which they brought me up in 99, teaming with my dad, but they really brought me up to work a program with him because he was 15, but he's a huge guy, 15. He was, you know, you understand, Rene was the youngest bodybuilding champion in Canadian history. He was Mr. Canada at the age of 17. In that same week, he was Mr. Canada. He also graduated from high school and was contracted by the WWE all in the same week at the age of 17. Okay. And I had to work a program with him. So Emil trained him, but I was the guy who polished, what we use the term polished Rene. And I tell people it's kind of weird they say that because I looked as Rene and myself kind of polished each other, even though I've been in 10 years more. But I never understood how Dad got the character until I got to tag with Dad. Then I understood. Then I just added more stuff to it and took it as my own.
What does polish mean exactly?
Well, it's a term we use, like polish, like you're polishing something like brass or anything, so you're going to make it shine. So I polished him and I made him shine. So when what happens to someone shines is they become a star. And that's what the whole the star is, because it's shining. We never really use that word star. Vince McMahon is the one who used that word. You know, we always said, when I started wrestling, you was either low card, mid card, or a main eventer, top card guy. And I was what you would consider what we call back in the day carpenters. And carpenters were wrestlers who were good wrestlers, but we were there primarily to make all the names look good on TV. But all the green guys or the newbies, the beginners, we're the ones that made them look good. So, you know, you would see us win over the smaller guys and then we would lose to the bigger name guys. And, but that's, you know, wrestling jargon is language we stole from Hollywood and we stole from the carnies when we was part of the carnies from the 1800s. That they were called at shows, athletic shows. They had boxing and wrestling combined. And this is the thing people don't understand, how controlled boxing is, because wrestling was controlled too. Well, if boxing and wrestling was once together in 1800s as part of that show and it was controlled to make money, then what do you think boxing is? It's a controlled environment. If you're not, Mike Tyson found out the hard way. He wasn't going to do business. They didn't care for him knocking people out. They just wanted him to do more rounds so they can make money, control the gambling. Mm-hmm. But
will you talk about, because I've been reading about this history too, will you talk about that history with the carnivals and
wrestling been around since the beginning of time. You know, it's the oldest sport. Running and is the other oldest sport, okay? When in the 1800s, of course, you know, the Civil War had happened, and then, of course, the Wild West. But wrestling was part of the things that the Irishmen brought over from Ireland. And they set up little wrestling camps, and then the carnies took them into the wing. So we was part of that carny. But they also had boxing, which was actually more fist than gloves. And part of that, plus the strongman that would bend the bars, all that was part of the athletic show, at shows, is what they called them. And wrestling was in its heyday, and that's where we actually, P.T. Barnum was the guy that actually created the colorful characters. Like, you would see a guy built from Russia, Moscow, Russia, but he would actually be speak with a southern accent from Georgia, you know, and create these fictitious biographies. And then he also was the one that created the work matches, because the boys actually was able to do that, the wrestlers. And what he would do was call the infamous shoot and hook. Shoot meaning real, and hook means you're hooking someone and you're manipulating to hook them into a legal hold, which would be breaking their wrist or ankle or whatever it may be. And it's at the beginning, for the week they run the carnival show. They show in the beginning, and they say, well, we're going to have a guy at the end of the week. You put your money in the pot, and anybody who can beat that guy, get the pot. And they would see this guy lose every day of the week. At the end, they reveal the wrestler, and it was a guy that lost every day of the week. But what the people didn't realize to put their money in the pot was that guy was the shooter, which was a real wrestler. And he was also the disciplinary guy to the other wrestlers, so, you know, to keep them in line. And then they put their money in the pot, and then they go into the wrestling, and he would dislocate their shoulders and hurt them. And he and the promoter would split the pot. And, but that's where you get your show business part. But the Hollywood aspect is we've always been – wrestlers has always crossed over with the vaudeville plays. As a matter of fact, in 1920, when the last real pro match took place between Ed Strangle Lewis and Joe Stecker for the World Heavyweight Championship, and it lasted for about 4.5 hours, one match. Everybody from the audience was already gone. Three referees collapsed from exhaustion. The fourth one stopped the match. Both Stecker and Lewis spent days in the hospital from injuries that they sustained from legitimately wrestling, so they went back to the Carney days and created the format of working a match, what we call working together, instead of wrestling, okay? That's why we use that word worker. When people come up to me and it's like, so you're a wrestler? I'm like, no, I'm a worker. The guys today aren't really workers. They don't realize what they're doing today is what wrestling became. But workers are people who worked the fans, knew how to work the fans, get the fans up and down, knew their place on the card, never went above from their match part in the card because you didn't want to take away from the main event. The whole point is to build up to your main event, which the wrestling card was based on a vaudeville play. Act one, act two, act three, match one, match two, match three. Now you see where that come from, okay? And that's where they adopted from, which was part of Hollywood. Wrestlers had done theater work. Wrestlers had done old movie work and stuff. And we adopted a lot of Hollywood slang in part of that, too.
Because I kind of had a theory, you know, people still can't get over the fact that it's, you know, a worked environment. But, you know, because it used to be part of all these other forms of theatrics and carnival presentations, wrestling's kind of a last holdover.
Well, wrestling, what happened is you had people coming out of the woodworks that brought their trade with them and brought into wrestling. Argentina and Rocca, okay? Well, he was a soccer player. Well, what he would do is he would wrestle barefoot and he would slap you in your face with his feet, okay? Another person that brought their trade with him was Ricky Starr, which was a ballet dancer. So he would actually do ballet dancing part of his routine. It was entertaining. And the guy that used TV for what it was for was a guy named George Wagner, which was the first TV superstar wrestling, which was Gorgeous George. Mind you, Lou Thesz was the world heavyweight champion at the time. Lou Thesz could not follow Gorgeous George if they was on the same car, so the world champion had to finish title before Gorgeous George because everybody was actually there to see Gorgeous George, which is actually the first time that they really used that superstar word because George went beyond a wrestler. He became a superstar. Another person that would do that later on, because you have peaks in wrestling. I mean, if you like take a diagram and a chart and high peaks and stuff, you know, your first peak was Frank Gotch, who was the first American to win the world heavyweight title in 1908 from George Hackenschmidt, which is the first world champion. He unified the European and American championship in 1905. And your second peak was Ed Strangle Lewis, which was a straight-up shooter. It was your first multiple champion because he can lose the belt and win it back whenever he wanted to because he was a real deal. Your next peak would be Lou Thesz, which was everything what Ed Strangle Lewis was a real wrestler. He could beat you anytime he wanted to. And then Gorgeous George came because of TV, and he became huge, okay? He started riots. He had these golden bobby pins. He called them Georgie pins. And would throw these bobby pins. People would have riots just to get a hold of a bobby pin. Okay, and they came to see him. The next peak would be Andre the Giant. And the reason why people have to understand is that there was only two athletes during Andre's time, two athletes in the world that was recognized by name. You didn't have the internet, you didn't have cable, you didn't have all this stuff, but there was two athletes that was recognized worldwide. Didn't matter who they were. That was Muhammad Ali and Andre the Giant. Everybody knew who they were in the world. They didn't know who Ric Flair was, because Ric Flair was just starting his career when Andre was top, and Hogan had just started his career later on, too. And then, of course, Cable came out, and then the match that changed everything. This is what I try to explain to people when they ask me what was the thing that changed wrestling to what it is today. That was when Hulk Hogan played Thunder Lips against Sylvester Stallone's Rocky Balboa in Rocky III in the boxer versus wrestler match in that scene. That's what changed wrestling. That's when Vince McMahon Jr. had bought the company from his dad, utilized Hulk Hogan because he remembered Superstar Billy Graham was over, and he was a heel, a bad guy, but he was getting over, but Vince Sr. didn't want to turn him, which he should have, because if he did, then Superstar Billy Graham would have been Hulk Hogan before Hulk Hogan came onto the scene. And Hulk Hogan mimicked and copied after Superstar Billy Graham. You see, so did Jesse the Body Ventura. And and Hulk Hogan became the marketable character, the cartoon face and stuff. So, and then Andre, what they would call passed the torch, but Andre was sick towards the end of his life and had to have surgery, and Vince Jr. paid for Andre's surgery. That's the only reason why Andre put Hogan over at WrestleMania 3. Plus, he became good friends with Hogan, and he knew his time was up, and it's time for wrestling to change. It was changing, and it's going to change. It was going to change regardless. Andre understood this. It was going to change regardless if Andre did it or not. Mm-hmm. So Andre just did the admirable and honorable thing, was to put over the new guy of the time, mm-hmm. which was Hogan. And then, of course, you had Austin and The Rock share their peak together, because Austin's career came short, and The Rock picked up where Austin left off. Then you had John Cena and Daniel Bryan. And unfortunately, today, which I think is a great thing, you have a woman that's the face of wrestling, which is Becky Lynch. And she's the new thing now. And, of course, that's just how wrestling is, you know, which that's the way it should be. And even though people like me and a lot of our older guys don't like it, but wrestling, it has been and always was about entertainment. It was about entertaining the fans, and we understood that. And any wrestler today, even though the matches should be considered exhibition, that's the actual terminology, because even though it's a controlled environment, same as boxing, an exhibition bout, they're not really trying to hurt each other, they're just trying to get money for a show. The thing is we understood that. No one's really beating nobody. Nobody's really losing. You know, wins, loss don't matter. It's about the performance and how you give the people more than money's worth in their ticket, and try to give them an escapism to get away from reality, just like you go to a movie or watch a TV show, and or any sporting events, escapism. You go watch a football game, you're not going there to see politics, which is, well, my beef with that Kirkpatrick guy. Yeah, I had nothing against people standing up and protesting. There's a proper place and time to do that, and you don't use the stage that made you and put you where you're at as that stage. People don't come to a football game, boxing match, or a baseball game, or a hockey game to see the news. They go to get away from that. Mm-hmm. So why would you go and use that platform as a thing? Now, wrestling would use those platforms as storylines to incorporate them, like Iraq War. My dad, for example, the Cold War, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis, you would use that. Iron Sheik used it because of Iran, and he actually was a bodyguard for Deshaun, was wrestled in the Olympics, and he incorporated the Iron Sheik for Iran, you know, and he had to change the name because there was already a Sheik before him, which was Farhat from Syria, and which he wasn't from Syria, but his descendants is. It's all character based, and but wrestling basically got its roots in the entertainment business from the Carney shows from being in the 1800s, and from P.T. Barnum, which mm-hmm. P.T. Barnum, I try to tell people, I believe Vince McMahon Jr. is P.T. Barnum reincarnated. You know, I mean, because only P.T. Barnum would come up with such ridiculous ideas that you got today. You know, today wrestling, it has its cycles and everything, and people talk about, oh, the ratings are down. It's okay. It's going through its normal phase. Mm-hmm. It's going through that, and it's going to change. And it changes every 10 years. And guess what? Next year is 2020. Yeah. Well, wrestling's changing. Mm-hmm. What it does is it evolves, and it will adapt to the proper time it'll find its place, you know, with or without Vince McMahon. It was doing it before him, it'll do it long after him. And that's what we do.
Let's go back and talk. I want to talk about your experience, your dad's experience, and wrestling in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. So since, why don't you introduce yourself just so we have it for the tape?
Well, my name is Richie Acevedo. My dad's name was Angel Acevedo. My dad wrestled as the Cuban Assassin, more known here in this area from WYTV4 Saturday Night Wrestling. I started my wrestling career in 1989 after I graduated from high school. My dad trained me, threw me in the ring basically, and I got the crap beat out of me every day, you know. But I live in West Virginia. I was raised in West Virginia. I was born in Paterson, New Jersey, but I was raised since I was 5 years old, 1975, in West Virginia. When I started off on my own, I only came back from Canada with one phone number, one name, which was Emile Dupree, and I had to go from that, and I had to go to wrestling shows to get on wrestling shows locally here in West Virginia and build up my own reputation. And when you're on the indies, or the independents, which independents existed back then in the territory days, my dad, they were called outlaw shows. People don't understand, they were called outlaw shows because they were outlaw because they didn't go within the guidelines of the NWA, the National Wrestling Lines, or they didn't go by the guidelines of the territory boundaries of promoters. They would be run shows regardless. That's where Jerry the King Lawler got his start too, was in outlaw shows, indie. And and so I had to get myself booked and everything. Of course, I had to start from here and work my way out. I wasn't the greatest wrestler, but what I learned was I was able to get myself over with the fans. So I developed and made my dad's character more colorful, I guess is what you would say. My dad, when he would wrestle, he would interact with the fans, but he wouldn't stick with them. Me, I'm always interacting with the fans. I would even be verbal with them and get myself over. And a lot of promoters and other bookers would be wrestling these other shows, and I would, and they would see me, and then they would get my phone number and book me for other shows, which started going to outside of the states of West Virginia, like Ohio, Pennsylvania, and so forth.
And what are some ways that you would get over?
Well, I mean, like one of the things, that's funny you bring that up. During the time when I was in the indies, trying to get myself going in the indies, you know, because I took some time off to go to the United States Marine Corps, it didn't work out, and working odd end jobs, and I would get myself, you know, I started in 89 and get myself back in the flow by 96 on the independent scene. By then, it was an attitude era was going on, and everybody had a saying, had their own little thing, you know, The Rock in Austin had their own little saying, and Ric Flair, which was the first guy to really have a real saying, was Ric Flair, and or Gorgeous George was too. Gorgeous George was the innovator of that. He was the master of gimmicks. I come up with "Shut Your Stinking Mouth," which I got that. You know, I would say "Shut your stinking mouth," and I got that from watching a videotape of Gorgeous George when he said, "Get your filthy hands off of me," you know, and. And I was like, how can I incorporate that into my character? And I happened to be watching a movie called The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And Tuco, the ugly in there, he's like, you know, in this one scene, and he's like, you know, well, you know, one stinking bastard, one bastard goes in, two stinking bastard comes out, and he said the word stink. And I was like, that word, you know, sound right to me. So, and I did the voice of Ivan, the Russian bear Ivan Koloff, and mixed with Sergeant Slaughter. So it'd be loud and shut your stinking mouth. And that's where that came from. And the other thing was Viva La Cuba, which in Spanish you wouldn't say Viva La Cuba, you would say Viva Cuba. It sounds like a stale chip, okay? And I'm trying to, like, how can I get Viva Cuba over? And this wrestler at the time called Super Mario, and he had a restaurant in Princeton, West Virginia, an Italian restaurant. He's Italian. And he comes up to me, he says, "Won't you say Viva La Cuba?" And I was like, nah, you know, that's saying Cuba's a town instead of in translation. He goes, no. Do your thumbs like you're celebrating yourself. Viva la Cuba, you know. And so, and then I was like, well, I'll try it. And I did it, and it stuck. And then people saying that. And then my dad went to say, son, you know you're supposed to be Viva Cuba. I said, yeah, I know that, Dad, but it just sounds so plain. And I just said, Viva la Cuba, and like I'm celebrating me, you know. And so, and I'm like, you know, Viva la Cuba. And that's the other saying I did. But how I got myself over was interacting with the fans, like, and Daniel Bryan, listen, I'm not taking away anybody. I don't know who gave him the idea, the yes, no. Vince gets his ideas from everybody else anyway. When I was wrestling, I seen, I still think, and I stole this from Lord Zoltan and another guy that was wrestling in the card, and they had Lord Zoltan and the referees asking him, you give up? No. Yes, and they get the baby face to say yes, and the fans would get, well, I did with the hair, you know. I was like, hey, you pull my stinking hair, you stinking ref. And then as I asked the fans, and they was like, no. I was like, yes, yes. And they said, no, back and forth. Well, I was wrestling on a show in Indiana, and Daniel Bryan was on that locker room, was young starting out, and so was CM Punk, okay? I was doing that then. Years before, Daniel Bryan was doing this whole yes thing, you know, and he got credit for that, but I can't take credit because I took it from someone else. But I did send tapes in years before Daniel Bryan came to the scene, so I guess that's where they won or down. I don't know who got the idea, but I was doing it years before, but I was doing it differently.
So things kind of get passed on, reworked.
Well, I mean, for example, the Ricky the Dragon Steamboat arm drag. And that everybody talk about Ricky Steamboat's arm drag. Well, he stole that from Jack Briscoe, you know, and Jack Briscoe stole that from Malenko, Boris Malenko. So, I mean, you know, we just take from each other. It's just one does it better than the other, and it just happens to work out. And just so you know, I was wrestling for Carlitos Colon, which is Carlito's dad, Carlos Colon, and in Puerto Rico in 2001. And this referee, I was working Eddie Colon, as a matter of fact. He goes as Primo. And I had him down, and I was kind of hot-tempered, and I didn't want Carlos to think I would hurt his boy. I would never do that. I'm professional in the ring. I would never take, you know. So, you know, I went to liven the thing up, and I asked, told the ref, ask him. He said, give up. He give up, ask him. He asked him, and I grabbed his head, and I was like, si, senor, I cannot take no more of the Cuban. And then, you know, Eddie's laughing. The referee just burst out, gets up. Oh, now I'm mad because the referees are over there slapping. Laughing. I was like, oh, he's killing my match. So I spat in his face. And guy's attention, the guy got real angry. And he confronted me in the locker room. We had words and stuff in the locker room, me and that ref. But then the promoter, Carlos, called me in, so I figured I was going to be fired. Okay, I can live with that. I understand. And I went to apologize to him. I was like, well, I understand. You know, I apologize. And he goes, no, amigo, that was beautiful. You seen the reaction of the fans? That's your new gimmick now. That's your gimmick. So he had me spit on people. But when that incident happened, that referee, I come back in that locker room. Guess who was sitting beside me and sat down beside me in the locker room? It was Carly Colon, which became Carlito. Okay, and he sat down beside me, and he says, what'd you do it for, man? And I just looked over at him, and I said, because he wasn't cool. Fast forward 5 years later, and now you have Carlito coming out. He says, I spit in the face of people who are not cool. And I was like, that's the total gimmick I had down in working for his dad. You know, so I was glad that worked out for him. But, you know, it's kind of funny how those things work better for other people than because I hated doing it. I thought it was disrespectful. I'm from West Virginia. I was raised by my mother. I was raised to be respectful. And they really want me to spit on them. And all these guys come to me, want me to incorporate that. And I just thought, and it's just, to me, it was disgusting, you know. So, but it worked for him, so, yeah.
Do you, or I wonder if your dad thought about this, especially as someone who is Puerto Rican, do you ever feel weird about being kind of a, being a, Hispanic stereotype?
No. When I was growing up, you know, and you have to understand, my mom, which I have a picture here somewhere, I'll show you in a minute, but My mom was one of the first people around here that would be in an interracial relationship, okay? Because my dad, on my Spanish side of the family in Puerto Rico, it's a mixture of black and white, okay? But when I was growing up, and people would pick on me, bully me and stuff, the same thing. I don't call it bullying. I was also raised in a time period where sticks and stones might break my bones, but words never hurt me, so I don't take offense to what people say. I learned that a long time ago. When I was growing up, people would pick on me. They would call me a little QB. They would, pick on me out, and they knew I was mixed race, okay? In school, it was either black or white. They didn't have any Spanish people when I was growing up. Me and my sister was one of the first ones, and later on, you have doctors that come over, and they have their kids later on. And by the time I got to, when I was growing up, it was people, I knew I was mixed race. But I never really got mad or upset about it. And you have to understand something. When I was growing up, I wasn't the guy that, the girls would be attracted to or anything. When I was growing up, I was always, when we played as kids, I was always the bad guy or the monster. I was never the hero or the good guy. I was always the bad guy or the monster. It was just me. When we played as kids, and this is, because we didn't have video games, we had to play to go outside and do stuff and use our imagination. So I didn't mind because I got attention from that. And who wouldn't love attention, especially when you're young, And even the adults, again, my dad was a bad guy in wrestling, so it just stuck with me, right? I was the bad guy and the monster. And then when I got older, I realized that I can say some stuff that is very offensive and not really mean to say something, but people would take it offensively if I said something. So I had to really watch what I say, or people want to get in a fight, and they would take this stuff literally. So I've been fights and stuff growing up, but I didn't hold it against anybody, of what they thought of me. As far as being stereotyped and being the Cuban, I looked like my dad. I act like him in a lot of ways. It just kind of fell in place. In the beginning, I didn't want to use my dad's character and name, but when people saw me, all they saw was my dad, and they would call me by my dad's name, Angel. I just learned to overlook these things, and I was like, maybe there's something here. So I was like, I just went ahead and ran with it. People can say, I'm not a millionaire, I don't have all this money, but to me it was never about the money. It was about doing what you love to do, having a good time doing it. I got to travel the world, okay? I met the woman that would be my future ex-wife, the mother of my two kids. I had gotten opportunities in life that I never would have got. I got opportunity where I got to get into the film and television industry. None of that stuff would have happened if I didn't do wrestling. And I understand that full well, and hardly, But that's just, to me, stereotyping, to use that word, to me, people make up their own offensive words. It's like propaganda. You create your own drama. You create your own thing. From wrestling, I learned that we create drama. Okay, we're going to get people angered. We're going to get them mad. We're going to make them happy. We're going to, you have all those emotions. That's what's great about a wrestling match, is you get all those emotions in there. Has everything. A match should have everything. It should have comedy, should have drama, should have action, adventure, and a good finale. Just like a good book, just like a good movie. And I learned to overlook the stereotyping stuff. I never got tired of it. I actually, after the beginning, I didn't want to, but after I saw what it can be and what I can do with it, I just took it as my own, and granted, yes, it's my dad's name, it's my dad's character. I look like him. And just like, you don't get too many opportunities to do what your dad, like my dad did. Let me tell you something. There's only a few men in wrestling today, a few men that can say that they tag team with their father and tag team with their son. And I'm one of those few men. Bob Orton Jr. tagged with his dad, Bob Orton Sr., and he tagged with his son, Randy. I got to tag with my dad, and I got to tag with my son, But I also went one step further. I got to wrestle my dad under the hood as Satanicus, and I got to wrestle my son, and I got to wrestle with my nephew, and I got to tag with my nephew. So, you know, to me, you know, I got to be a blessed man. And they do wrestling, starting off just like any other person does today in Independence, and they've been doing it for over a year and a half. It'd be 2 years coming in May. If they want to stick to it, I'm behind them. If they don't, I understand. It's, you know, not going to be for everybody. But at least they tried and they put their hand in it, and then don't know if it's for them or not. To me, it just turned into something that I enjoyed. I hated it in the beginning. I won't deny that. But I end up embellishing it, learned the history of our profession, the whole history. And I also learned, you know, from wrestling how to be a better person in, you know, in society and in every other yonder, because you can't be a bad guy 24/7, you know. And but I had so many people come up to me because I don't give them a negative. I never had to use swear words in my matches. I just say shut your stinking mouth. And you know, and I don't try to. I tried some of that stuff before, and it just didn't work, and it really was offensive. And I wanted to. I figured that the best way to get your character over as a heel or a bad guy to be convincing is to be that bad guy that still has rules. The best bad guy is the one that has that sets himself in standards and rules, just like a good villain in a movie. You know, all his henchmen are getting killed left to right, but the reason why he's the main bad guy because he set himself to his own standard or his own rules. And I was like, well, I want to do that too, you know, but I wanted to be positive influence, so that way if kids was to mock me, I didn't do the DX crotch thing and nothing like that. I was always just such a stick of mouth. So when kids imitated me, some kids did, and some kids grew up, became wrestlers because of me, which I didn't find out until later on, like 2013. I was in Kentucky on a show, and this big black guy, huge muscular black guy, he comes up to me and he said, he leaned and goes, was you the Cuban that wrestled for Bull Miller and IWA back alley brawl? And I was like, Yeah, it was back in 97, 98, 99. And he said, yeah, I used to come there and watch you guys wrestle in Columbus, Ohio. I said, really? I said, how old was you then? He goes, I was 10 years old. I said, oh, really? He goes, yeah. I said, well, who else do you remember from over there? And he goes, well, I don't remember too many guys, but I remember you because you was different from everybody else. And he said, and I said, I was different. He said, yeah. He goes, you was out there and say, shut your stinking mouth. And he goes, you was completely different. And, you know, and it stood out. I'm only 5'7". And to be the short guy in the car, but to be the guy that's going to be in the main event, to be the guy that draws attention, my whole motto was always make sure they pay attention to you, no matter what, no matter who's on, whatever. And he said, well, you're the reason, one of the reasons why I became a wrestler. And I said, don't tell your mom that, because I'm sure she wouldn't like that, you know. But he asked me to critique his match. I watch his match. He's really good. And then he comes back, and I was like, well, you did good. I didn't see no problems. And he goes, well, I'm getting ready to leave to Japan in 2 weeks. I said, Japan? He said, yeah. I said, well, you already made it. I said, if you make it in Japan or you go to WWE, you made it. Either way, you know, because they pay you big money over there. And I was like, well, you didn't need my advice. You should be telling me advice from my matches, you know. So. And yeah, but but to see people say that, and there's a lot of people. Jason the Gift Kincaid watched me wrestle, and I think he's going to be a future star for the company. And a young girl in Canada named Madison Miles is making a name for herself now. And she was a little kid. I got a picture on my Facebook with me when she was a little kid, and in 2008, I believe. And now she's making a name for herself, and she's already had a dark match tryout for WWE, so she's going to be there soon. And it's weird because I had met Sasha Banks when she started off. I had no clue she was Snoop Dogg's cousin. You know, I knew it was Mercedes, and she was just starting out. I had met Rebecca Knox. She was gone as Rebecca Knox, but her name is Rebecca Quinn. She's Becky Lynch. And I saw how smart she was then, and she was doing this thing where she was screaming. And I asked her, I said, "Why are you always screaming for?" I mean, she literally would scream. And what her response was to me, and this is when she was starting out, And she goes, well, why do you? And I was like, what do you mean, why do I? I don't scream. She goes, yeah, you do. I never thought about it. One time I said, shut your stinking mouth, I am screaming. You know, so you think about it. If she was that smart then, so she is exactly where she's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. Same with Sasha Banks. All of them. Everybody that's there deserves to be there. They all worked hard for it. They all busted their butt and got there. And they deserve the break they got. I had opportunities to try to be part of it, but it just didn't work out. I wasn't cosmetic enough for them to market for toys and video games. That's what it boils down to.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell me about how your dad passed on the tradition to you, and, you know, just through observing and through how what he taught you?
Well, I'll be honest. When my dad was training me, he didn't, what we call smarten up. He didn't smart me up to the business. He didn't educate me to the business. My dad just taught me how to take certain falls, okay, in one day, and threw me out there in the ring. And I was getting the crap beat out of me every night, okay. My first match was with a guy named Eddie Watts on PEI, Prince Edward Island, Montague PEI. As I was under the mask of the Super B. I come out, and I get in the ring with Eddie. And the referee's reading the rules between us, you know, going over his spiel. And Eddie stops the referee, and he looks at me. He goes, I don't care who your dad is, and I ain't going to be easy. And I'm like, what's he saying? So I go to hook up with him. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. We're in separate locker rooms back then, you know. And all I had was the finish of the match. All I knew is Eddie was winning by a neck breaker. That's all I knew. I didn't know what was going. I didn't know what was going to happen. I go out there. Eddie hooks up with me, and he gives me this knee to my gut. He hits me really hard, so it knocks the wind out of me. I bend over. He comes over, gives me a what's called a high knee lift. And that's where he gives hitting you with your knee when you're bent over. But he smacks his hand on my back. Well, I stood up like this, just because the stinging in my back. He gets mad. He grabs me by the mask, pulls me down, gives me this hard forearm to my back, and I go straight down to the canvas. I'm only 180 pounds when I started. I look up. I still can't breathe. I still got the stinging on my back from his hand. I look up, and this big boot comes, hits me right in the face, real hard. The only thing I remember from that moment on is I remember the ceiling and the lights in the ceiling going around in circles. Next thing I know, I hear the bell, ding, 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 and then the referee's helping me back, and the referee's sitting there saying, man, that was amazing. I'm sitting there not coherent what he's saying to me, and I come back to the locker room. I come in. I'm still trying to figure out what just happened, you know, and I hear guys in the locker room, my dad, Cuban, 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 your son's a natural, your son's a natural. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, natural. I just naturally got my butt whipped, you know. And it was not, of course, it was natural, you know. And then the next night I come out, and there's Eddie Watts again. Same thing. Next night, Eddie Watts. Next night, Eddie Watts. Next night. I mean, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm getting the crap beat out of me every night. I'm sore. I'm trying to. I want to cry, but I'm not gonna cry. You know, I'm not in the same locker room as my dad. I'm in different locker room with these other guys. I'm in the shower. Only time I would cry, I'd be taking a shower in the locker room because you couldn't see my tears, with, you know. And that's true. I would literally be crying in the shower trying to figure out, you know, I can't quit because it's my dad. And then I'm sitting in Andy Knish, and had this, the locker rooms are separate, but they had to go in the same hallway to go out to the arena. I'm sitting there looking out, waiting for my time to come out, dreading what's going to come to me. And I hear a guy say, Richie. I look over, and it's Rotten Ron Starr. One, like, at that time, was the third most dangerous guy in the wrestling business. It was Dr. D. David Schultz was one of them. Gypsy Joe was the other. And then you had Rotten Ron Starr. I just seen this guy almost kill a guy. I seen this guy, a guy sped on him, and he headbutted the guy, knocked him out, broke his nose from a headbutt. And he says, Richie. And he's covering his mouth up like this. He says, Richie, he goes, when you get out there, I want you to hit him, and I want you to hit him hard. And I was like, are you kidding me? You know, I didn't want to make him mad. You know, he's already beating the crap out of me, right? He says, you hit him. I don't care. You go out there and you hit him, and you hit him hard. He goes, if you don't hit him hard when you come back here, I'm going to beat the crap out of you. He didn't say it in those words, but, you know, I'm like, this is a big deal. This guy's telling me he's going to beat the crap out of me if I don't do something in that match. I got there. I'm wrestling Eddie again, and Eddie's beating the crap out of me. I happen to look over, and there's Ron Starr, his arms crossed, standing there in the entrance. I mean, it's only one hallway. And he's sitting there shaking his head, and he has this mean look, and he's shaking his head. No, you know. I'm like, oh, crap. I was like, you know, he's just sitting there waiting for me to come back to that hallway. And I'm like, I look at Eddie, and I look at him. I'm already getting the crap out of me from Eddie. So what's a little bit more getting beat up over, right? At least it's Eddie getting beating the crap out of me, not this dangerous guy who's going to kill me. So I just reached back. I was on my knees, and I closed my eyes, and I threw a punch as hard as I could and hit him in the gut. Eddie bent over. His eyes were, like, real big. And I was like, uh-oh, here it comes. And then Eddie goes, first time he ever spoke to me in any of the matches, that's it. Do it again. Do it again. And then I hit him again, and I'm hitting him hard, too. And he's like, do it again. And he's backing up when I'm hitting him, and he grabs my arm. He says, shoot me off and backdrop me. So first time he ever talked to me in a match. And then next thing I know, we're having this killer match. I come after the match is over with, I go to walk back, and Ron Starr's not there. I go in the locker room, and my dad happened to be on this side of the locker room. And my dad's sitting down, and he says, huh, it's about time. And he didn't use those words. He used a couple swear words in there. He's like, about effing time. And I was like, what do you mean? And he says, I was wondering when you're going to stop letting someone just beat you up and start doing something. But if it wasn't for Ron Starr, I would never understood that the business was about working together in there. But he's the guy that smartened me up. And then Leo Burke saw that, you know, that I had something there. So Leo Burke kind of would give me advice too. So I had the best of both worlds. And my dad's always my harsh critic, even to this very day. He's still my harshest critic, you know. But that's Dad. You know.
Did he want you to be a wrestler?
No. It just happened that way. I think my dad would have preferred me being something other than a wrestler. I know since I've been doing acting in movies and TV, it seems to pique his interest on that. But it's just that when I graduated, my dad flew me up to Canada. And he was wrestling for Emile Dupree then, Atlantic Grand Prix Wrestling, Rene Dupree's dad. And my dad didn't believe in me having free living. I was in a motel, an apartment with him, Jerry Morrow, which is a tag team partner, and Frenchie Martin, who just got released from Vince McMahon at WWF, then World Wrestling Federation, which was he was the manager of Dino Bravo. And so Jerry would do the laundry. My dad would cook. Frenchie, you know, would help clean up. And so I had to wash dishes. And you know, and stuff. So I had to pay my own keep. And my dad just didn't like me to do free living. So he just trained me to put me as a body in the ring for an extra person for the show to help out the promotion. It just, when I left and came back, it's just something I could do on the side. So wrestling is like a trade skill. It was something you can always fall back on. And I was working these fast food restaurant jobs and nodding in jobs and I was just fall back on wrestling. It just took off and it just happened. It wasn't that my dad planned it, wanted me to be. and, you know, my dad probably would have preferred me to be a boxer instead of a wrestler because my dad really loved boxing. My dad loved boxing. My dad loved baseball. He thought I should be a baseball player. I wanted to be a cartoonist or an airline pilot is what I wanted to be. And instead, I became a storyteller, and that's what wrestlers are. We tell stories. And, you know, all wrestling matches are many stories of a big story. And so it's like a movie, but like with different chapters, different stories, you know. And that's what wrestling basically is. And I just became a storyteller. And, you know, it just happened. It's not that I planned it, Dad planned it. It just turned out to be that way, you know. So, I mean, my son works a regular job. My nephew works a regular job. They both wrestle. if they want to continue, that's on them. If they don't, but you know, if to be a wrestler, you have to devote yourself, and you got to sacrifice a lot. I mean, I sacrificed relationships, I sacrificed rent. I went so far for broken promises just to do a match, you know, and I still do. And just because I love to be a part of the business, but I'm coming towards the end of my career. I actually retired like 5 times and came back, you know. But when I turn, I'm going to be 50 in September next year, and I made a promise to myself, and I intend to keep that promise, that I would never be wrestling at 50. Yeah, if I'm going to wrestle at the age of 50, it's got to be money involved because I'm just getting older. And I remember I did this thing, a live feed on my Facebook, announced my retirement this past September, and someone made a comment, oh, you're still young. Well, you know, yeah, 50 is still a young age. But as an athlete, as a performer, you know, 50 is old. And it doesn't matter how you look at it. It doesn't matter. You can put down 0 from 100 on a piece of paper. 50 smack dab in the middle of it. 50 is half a century old. Okay, so, I mean, how much more do you think I can do? You know, I think I gave enough. And I want to continue the acting a little bit, maybe see where it goes. I'm not trying to be a star. I'm not trying to be rich. It's just something else I like to do.
Are you planning a last match?
You know, I try to plan those 5 times before. And I figure if it'll happen, regardless who it may be. I tried it 5 times. I had picked my opponent. If I had my say, I would prefer it being with my son, you know, to give him the credibility that he needs, if he wants it. You know, if not my son, then maybe my nephew, you know. But regardless who the last match, I'm not playing it this time around. Like I said, I planned it 5 times before. I mean, and it just, you know, to me, I just think if it's going to happen regardless. So one, no matter who it may be, it's just going to be the last one, you know, I'm going to do. And I just don't want to be wrestling with 50. And if I'm going to wrestle with 50, it's going to have to be some money involved in it because I'm just an old man at that point, and nobody – entertainment business is cosmetic. I don't care what anybody says. It's always about the young. You know, listen, there's a reason why people pay money to see Jennifer Lawrence in a movie. It's because she's young, okay? All right? Even Betty Davis only lasted for so long while she was young, and she got older, she had to play these older roles. Well, I mean, in wrestling, you get older, what are you going to do? And you can see it evident, for example, Triple H, you know, guy my age, maybe a couple years older. Every time he steps in the ring now, he gets hurt. He, even though he's in great shape, he's still an old man, okay, in wrestling, an athlete, you know. Right. I'm not trying to be disrespectful towards it. It's just the facts. Mm-hmm. You don't see football players, a quarterback, you know, playing football when he's 50. You know, so, you know, I mean, what's this quarterback name that's in the New England Patriots now? I can't think of his name, but
Brady?
That's it, Tom Brady, yeah. And, you know, he's trying to do everything he can now to be the best, which he is the best. He just doesn't realize it yet. You know, he's broke all these records because he knows that he's getting close to the age that he can't do it no more, and he's going to have to step down. He's going to have to. Well, he's going to deflate his ego on top of it, too. But, I mean, the ego is what made him a star. Mm-hmm. But, and of course, and just so everybody knows, that deflating balls is not really illegal in NFL. They just made a big deal about it. You can deflate the balls. It's just how he went about it was just the wrong way, you know. But he's the best in football, and he will be for a long, long time, until some other young punk comes along with a bigger ego than his, and he'll knock him off the block. Mm-hmm. You know, but he's coming to the end of his career. He knows he's going to have to stop, so he's going to go out in the big bang. Mm-hmm. Well, the same with wrestlers, you know. And here Hogan is in his 60s, going to be 70, wanting to have one more match, okay? So, yeah. I mean, and he has tons of injuries,
yeah, sure.
Okay? Surgeries, multiple surgeries from what he, you know, and we call it paying our dues. He's done more than he paid his dues. He's done, And I'm like, what more can anybody do? And the last thing I want to be is that guy. Yeah. I'm not disrespecting, you know, like Ricky Morton. Mm-hmm. God bless his soul. You got there. That's all you know. That's all you do. Great. I got it. I get it. Understand. But I always worked a job on the side, so that way I paid into my Social Security, so that way when 62 comes around, I'm taking my early retirement. And because if you live that long from what we do, you broke the odds. So I'll take my early retirement and, you know, and I'll probably still work a little bit on the side of job to keep myself going, because I one thing I also learned is that when you just stop, it's when everything's over with for you. And but yeah, I mean, I don't have any plans for a real last match. Mm-hmm. I would like it to be, like I said, my son or my nephew, but whoever it'll be, it'll be whoever. And I'll just take my rightful place and step down and let the next people mm-hmm. take the spot that deserves a spot and leave it to the young like it's supposed to be.
Now that we're so far from the Cuban Missile Crisis and Americans can travel to Cuba now and Castro's gone, do you see people respond as much to the Cuban assassin?
Well, people always respond to the character, regardless if they're educated about the Cuban Missile Crisis or not. Well, I do an elbow off the top rope, and they dubbed that the Cuban Missile Crisis. I didn't name it. They did. And someone had a joke, because I always had the guy move when I come off the top. And the guy, the commentary guy, is like, the Cuban Missile Crisis had been averted. The Cuban Missile. And then so it just became a joke, so I just call it that. But people still react. I still get recognized for what I do. It is great people are allowed to go to Cuba. I find that a great thing, because I do have family in Cuba. My grandmother's Cuban, my dad's mother, you know.
Is
my
this her?
Yep, mm-hmm. And that's my grandfather, and he's Portuguese. That's where the family name is Portuguese. And my grandmother's from Cuba, her family, okay? So, you know, I think it's great. But just so you know, Fidel Castro is gone, but his brother Raul Castro got control. So Castro's still in charge. Mm-hmm. And there's still things between the governments. It's always going to be there. But a lot of people don't understand the whole reason the Cuban Missile Crisis took place, and they really need to understand their history. It was never about, really, the Russian missiles. The Russian missiles came into play. What it was is when Fidel Castro got into power, and he ran out Batista, because Batista was working with the mafia, and Fidel Castro wanted to do trades with the United States reached out to him to do trades, and he wanted to trade tobacco and sugar cane, okay? But the American government didn't want to pay him the amount of money they were paying other countries for their sugar cane and their tobacco, and he thought it was an insult. Well, you're paying them this much. How come you can't pay us? We're just right here off your coast. I mean, we'll grow it all. I'm not trying to make Castro look like a good guy. He wasn't anything, but he was a dictator. He was a ruthless man. But as a businessman, he was trying to do business, and then it turned into a thing where, well, if you're not going to, you know, that's when they used and said, well, you must be communist. So they made him communist. So since they declared him communist, well, what's he going to do? He's going to welcome Russia, communist. Bring your missiles over here. Yeah, sure. If you're not going to do business with me, I'll do business with them. If you're going to call me a communist, I'm going to be a communist. So that's what happened. And that's the actual history of it, you know, and that's what people don't understand. They really need to understand history. What you're taught one thing in school is what they want you to know. And when you, in real history, if you go and study it, and I learned my travels in real history, and, you know, he was a ruthless dictator, there's no doubt. He killed people, he murdered people. I mean, that's how he got into power, and he became a dictator. But he was a socialist, but, you know, not completely communist until they labeled him as a communist, and that's what happened on that. It was, and that's why they put the embargo trade, and that's where the Cuban Missile Crisis came into play, and then that's where my dad came up with the character of the Cuban assassin, because my dad's from Puerto Rico, not far from Cuba. I mean, there's only so many miles between, you know, Florida and Cuba, and Cuba's the bigger island of all the surrounding islands, and Puerto Rico is just a small island of one of those islands. And it's Puerto Rico is also part of the Bermuda Triangle. It's one of the points of the triangle. It's a beautiful place, but still like a third world country down there. And after the hurricane last year, was it last year or the year before? But it's, I got family still live down there, and they're still trying, they're still recuperating from it. And of course, America wasn't there for them.
Right.
And you know, that's just the politics, and it's just sad because in politics people get affected by it. And in this case, that's what happened down there. And they're still restructuring, they're still trying to build, they're still trying to get back on their feet. You know, I was honored to wrestle in Puerto Rico. But I'll tell you, too, that they still owe me money. They owe me $900, to be exact. And they owe my dad like $1,200. And that was Carlos. But I learned that when they stiff you in your pace because you're over, they're not going to tell you that you're a star because then you want more money. They'll try to keep you on that island as long as they can, but I bought my own airline ticket, so you know they couldn't keep me prisoner, and like they did a lot of guys. But I was honored because those wrestlers were some of the best wrestlers I ever got to be in the ring with, was all those Puerto Rican wrestlers down there. And when I was in Stampede the year before, up in for the Hearts, man, that was, I had gotten to wrestle almost a person from a different country, literally, over in Stampede. They, people come all over the world to train.
And
with,
where was that?
That was in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, for Stampede Wrestling, for the Hart family.
Okay.
People would come from around the world to be trained with the Harts. And they, and how I got booked for that, my dad would never keep a freaking telephone line open, you know, for me to get a hold of him. Stubborn old man, and I was like, well, I got Ross Hart's number, you know. My dad had gave me Ross Hart's number to call in case my dad needed to get booked or something. And I just called Ross, left a voicemail on his answering machine, and just said, you know, I need to get in touch with my dad. This is his son Richie. Can you call me back? He calls me back, but not to get a, tell me about dad or get a hold of dad. He calls me back to book me for Stampede Wrestling. And, hey, you know, hey, we're interested in bringing you up and all that. I was like, well, you know, I'm only called to get him. Well, I'll give the message to your dad, but, man, you really should come up, and, you know, we can pay you this amount. And I talked to with my wife at that time because I was married. And so I went ahead and went up there to do it and team with my dad again. And but it was a blessing because I got to wrestle a guy from a different country. I was wrestling a guy from Scotland. That guy went to WWF later on as one of the Highlanders. There's two guys that's in WWE now that was there. That's Jinder Mahal, and the other guy was one of the Ascension, the smaller guy. They were both there starting off when I was there. They were just young, skinny punks then, you know. And I shouldn't say punks. They were real nice guys. I was more of the punk. I was, but I got to wrestle a guy from Japan. I got to wrestle a guy from Korea. I got to wrestle a guy from Russia. I got to wrestle a guy from England. All these different flavors. Yeah, all these different flavors from different countries. And you learn, and I wanted to learn their style wrestling because they do it differently. So I wanted to do their style wrestling and give them their kind of match. So I learned all those styles from those people. And that was like one of the best experiences of my life. And in Puerto Rico, I love wrestling those guys down there. And listen, I speak a little bit of Spanish. To go into another country, another world, and when I wrestled the Japanese and those, I didn't speak their language. And to have a match, and actually have a match that really, you guys got chemistry, and the fans have a reaction to it that's really big, I would not have gotten over in Puerto Rico if it wasn't for the guys I was in the ring with. You're only as good as the guy that you're working with in that ring. They're the ones that was, you know, making me that star down there, if you want to use that word. But they were the ones that was building me. If it wasn't for them, I would have never gotten over. You know, and that includes Eddie Colon too, Primo Colon. If it wasn't for those guys, any of those. And I had great matches with all of them, Black Boy, all of them, Richie Santiago, all of them. I mean, I had such good chemistry with them, Thunder and Lightning, man. And then those guys, you know, just great. And same with Stampede. I was in the rings with these really, really good, polished, well-crafted performers. And I was really blessed, you know, to do that, because you don't find that too often,
yeah.
Especially today. You don't. If you get that, it's a rarity.
I don't want to take too much more of your time. I just have two questions. So this chapter that I'm working on will focus on like wrestling in West Virginia as a tradition,
yeah.
And like a community phenomenon. So what do you think is particular about wrestling in West Virginia, and why is it popular? Why is it maybe having a resurgence?
Well, wrestling never went away in West Virginia, in my opinion. I was a part of the whole culture. I wrestled all over the state of West Virginia, in every little nick and cranny places, and dressed in locker rooms, bowler rooms, closets, outside in the parking lot. I had to come dressed, you know, pup tents, all of it. You know, I've worked for everybody in West Virginia. There's promotion. There's people who don't promote no more, and there are promoters that still are promoting. Wrestling in West Virginia is heritage, okay, just like coal mining. Wrestling and coal mining were two big things from Saturday Night Wrestling. You have to understand, when TV first came out, it was invented in 1952. Well, wrestling, Saturday Night Wrestling, WOY24, started in 1954 and lasted until 1977. And the only reason why that stopped was because the TV studio burned down, okay? But then other wrestling came in its place, like ICW, International DePafos, ICW, then Smoky Mountain Wrestling, you know? But there's always been wrestling in West Virginia. And I enjoyed wrestling in West Virginia, and because one of the first places I got to take off to see was West Virginia, then the United States, then the world. And I had a lot of great matches in West Virginia, and a lot of my matches on my YouTube channel are from West Virginia. But I think it's more heritage. I don't think it's really went away. I think it has its peaks, just like WWE, you know, wrestling in West Virginia. And these guys literally start off with nothing. And they start off, and listen, some of the guys, you know, I was there when they started, like, what's his name, Rage, Rocky Rage. I was there when he started, when he was a skinny little boy, okay? I was there when Shane Matthews started. You know, I was there long before they were there. I mean, I was wrestling at least 15 years before they started, okay? And to see these guys develop, and to see them still doing it, and still doing it for the love, because Lord knows it's not for the money. If some wrestlers get lucky to make a payday, but you do it because you love to be a part of it and you want to be a wrestler. And this is a good starting point. And the thing about West Virginia wrestling is that West Virginia's got good credibility of being a good worker, a performer, a wrestler, whichever word you want to use, it's the same. You know, I like to call myself a worker, okay?
Why is that exactly?
Because I know how to work the fans, because I'm working the fans. I'm working the match. I'm making the other guy that I'm wrestling with look better than what he walked in. He walks out with a match with me, I'm going to make him look 10 times better. And that's a guarantee for me completely, because I can guarantee that because I'm a worker. The best way to know how you're a worker is, like a lot of these guys today, we're all in the same locker rooms now, even the women. You know, God bless them, because, you know, they have to put up with women in wrestling put up with more than they do. They put up with more than, you don't want to talk about sexual harassment, sex. Women put up with more than anything in this business, okay? If you're, and God bless them, because that shows the mentality that they want to be a part of it, and they do it. And that's not just here in West Virginia, it's everywhere around the world, okay? And that's why women wrestling is like took off. It's like a big thing now. But West Virginia wrestling, these guys and everything, they take off. But, you know, I can tell them, you want to be, how you know you're a worker is if you're in two separate locker rooms and all you both only had the same finish, and you got to, and you work something out, that's a worker. When you're calling your match in the locker room, I don't call my match out in the locker room. I call my match in the ring, okay? Otherwise, I'm an artist. I got a blank canvas, which happens to hence the word canvas on the ring, okay? Mm-hmm. So I paint my masterpiece, so you get a genuine one of a kind. And today, people paint by numbers, so it's the same routine, okay? But, you know, nothing against that. It works either way it goes. If they want to call it back there, it's just what it became. And I accept that. A lot of my other brothers that are my age and older won't accept it. They're still stuck in whatever time period that they're in. Not me. But you know, That's why I call myself a worker. But the actual word is performer. We're all performers, you know, but you can call yourself a wrestler if you want to do that. And there are legitimate guys that can really wrestle in this business. But if you watch them, they're not really wrestling. They're just performing, you know. But that's why I call myself a worker. So if you want to be a worker, performer, wrestler, it's all the same. It's entertainment business. It's the bottom line. It's what we are. It's you know, we're sports entertainment. That is the correct terminology for what we are. And Vince McMahon Jr. Created that word, and that's the actual true word. And I'm not trying to say it to boast Vince McMahon. It's just the truth. And he's just the first person to come out and tell the truth about it. But that's why I call myself. But I think wrestling in West Virginia is heritage. It's heritage. It's like coal mining. It's like, you know, it's just heritage. And these guys really go out and give 100%, if not more, put their bodies at risk today, more than what we did, and give an entertaining match, you know, and give these people more than the money's worth, their hard-earned money, to come see a show. And ASW is one of those promotions that started from nothing and worked his way up. And I got to give Gary Dameron his credit for that. And I got to give, even though he don't use me all the time, but I'm not going to knock what's working. And you know, and plus you got Stephen P. New, which is a friend of mine, and having him as a financial partner is always a good plus. And Stephen P. New can really help put that wrestling into which Stephen P. New is a wrestler, and he grew up with wrestling. For example, he's a lawyer, but he grew up with wrestling. He loves wrestling. You go talk to the guy, he's going to talk about wrestling, okay? And more than me, and I'm a wrestler. You know, I think it's just heritage. Wrestling in West Virginia is heritage, is what I believe it is. And the reason why it's growing up so much more is because it's the other option. People getting tired of watching WWE on TV. So now you got more options out there. Now you got AEW out there. And now there are other brand NXT, which is better than Raw and SmackDown. And you got Impact Wrestling, NWA Power. You got New Japan Pro, Ring of Honor. You got Lucha Underground, WOW, Women Wrestling there. And it's just another alternative. People just growing to something that's closer, more affordable, and they know they're going to see top names, superstars come to that show, and they're going to see, you know, people who's going to become a future superstar. So you're supporting that guy to become a superstar, and everybody starts from the independents. Everybody starts from the bottom, and you go to the top, and what happens when you get them to the top, you come back down. Only so very few can stay on the top, so, and that's only a few of them, but you know, not everybody's going to be Dwayne Johnson either, but at least everybody will give it their shot. And I think West Virginia wrestling is just heritage.
Yeah. I've been curious if wrestling came to coal camps. Have you ever heard about that?
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, wrestling before TV, I mean, it was just another venue that come through town like a circus, like a carnival. We adopted that. You know, rock and roll adopted the tour, which came from carnies, okay? Carnies were the first people to tour anything, to go anywhere. And wrestling was one of those part of this tour. That's what we do. And they came to coal camps. You know, all these towns, you're in a town that started from a coal camp. The coal camp was down here in Whipple and Carlisle. And the first town in Fayette County was over there in Gatewood. It was a coal camp, okay? Every community started out as a coal camp. So wrestling came to all the coal camps. Of course it was going to. It came from the Irishmen that brought it over here from Ireland and all that, and developed into, and they would wrestle and put on shows and exhibitions to make money. Whether it was a shoot, which means a real match, or if it was a work, which means it was a show. But they did the same thing. The coal camps is what started. I mean, what do you think in Civil War, what do you think they were doing to pass time? Mm-hmm. They wrestled. And what do you think Abraham Lincoln was doing? How do you think he became a command of a regiment? He wrestled. And he was a real wrestler. Oh. And he's wrestled in his lifetime, he wrestled over 500 matches. Mm-hmm. Okay? And those were real matches. Wow. Okay? And why he's not in the Hall of Fame, I have no idea. He should have been the first one. You know, that's what we did in coal camps. They came here, it just developed. And when, like, WY took off on the air, what's the first thing? They were hungry for programming. Mm-hmm. Just like the Dumont Network, which became later on ABC, okay? And when I was a kid growing up here, ABC and CBS was together in the same channel. Okay, WOY was both of them, and then all of a sudden they had to pick one, so they chose ABC as affiliate, right? But when they started off in 1954, WOY, one of the first things they had to have on here was on their TV was wrestling. Okay, because that's what people loved around here. And I'm gonna tell you something else. People talk about Vince McMahon giving out the truth about wrestling being a work or a show. Well, Saturday Night Wrestling did that before Vince McMahon ever did. They had to put it on there to avoid the state athletic taxes. I mean, they got arrested before. You know, they got arrested. Okay, they got arrested, and they had to put a disclaimer saying that all matches were prearranged. It didn't matter to the people. They still believed. The suspension disbelief, they still believed. They wanted to believe. And like I tell people in wrestling, our job isn't trying to convince people wrestling is real. Our job is trying to help them forget that it's not.
Right.
Okay? And that's what entertainment is. It's escapism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what we do. We entertain people just like a TV show or a movie. It's just live theatrics. It's live drama. And I think it's the best drama. But I'm kind of being biased because I'm a wrestler, but I just think it's the best drama.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, to me, they've wrestled with coal camps. They wrestled, that's where they originated here in West Virginia, was coal camps.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same pretense. I mean, it's not just to me, it's an American pastime more than baseball. I can tell you that. Before baseball became a big thing, before basketball, before football, wrestling was the thing. Wrestling, boxing, and horse racing was the American thing. So I think wrestling is as American as American apple pie. In West Virginia, I think it's just as part of the heritage of the state. It's just as much part of the heritage, you know.
What brought your dad to West Virginia?
He got booked. Gypsy Joe, which was wrestling Gene Madrid. It's one of the Madrid brothers, not really brothers. And this is the thing that's so funny too. He booked Dad and brought him up. It was supposed to be my dad and my uncle. My uncle didn't come, so they put someone else with him. Okay, and it was before Frank too. Before Frank came in the picture, which is the other Cuban assassin. And here's the funny thing: the Madrid brothers were the biggest heels, the biggest bad guys here. And in one night, and in one match, they became from being the top bad guys to the top good guys, top baby faces in one night because of my dad, okay, and the other Cuban assassin. And then my dad became the top bad guy in West Virginia wrestling. And that's why we call ourselves a Cuban dynasty, because in all honesty, we are the heritage. My son, my nephew, myself, we are the royalty from wrestling. We are the connection to that past.
Right.
There's nobody else. You know, there's nobody else. And everybody knows that. But my family is the wrestling royalty from that time period of wrestling from the past to the present. And not just from here, but from my dad's also a big name in Canada. He doesn't realize how big of a star he is in Canada. Of course, he don't like using that word.
Mm-hmm.
But he is. But that's what brought my dad here, was he got booked, and he came here, wrestled for a few years, and he got booked to Canada, then Japan, and he just stayed in Canada. He fell in love with Canada, so he stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom brought my sister and me back in 75, and my dad agreed to put us through school. When I was a kid, I was speaking three different languages. I was speaking English, French, and Spanish. We were in the French provinces in New Brunswick, okay? But my dad was speaking Spanish. So when I come back, I was speaking three languages. Well, guess what? Back then, it was unheard of. So you know what they did? They made me go through speech therapy and speech classes and just pounded English into me. So now I speak a little bit of Spanish and a little bit of French. It's like I almost forgot the whole narrative, but the thing is, when I'm around it, I can understand them completely, 100% understand what they're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them don't realize that. And you know, it's just because I can't speak it fluently. it's because they pounded on me, because that time period, like I said, that time period was unheard of for that to happen, so they couldn't have that. So they pounded English. They made me go through, they used to call reading labs in school, made me go through that, made me constantly English, and that's what happened. Mm-hmm. And but I understand what they're saying. You know, I can't always translate back. I do my best to, and when I'm around it more, when I found out when I was in Puerto Rico, I was picking it up pretty good. Mm-hmm. And when I wrestle in Canada, when I'm around it, I was picking up the French pretty good too. So it will come back if I'm around it more, but I choose to stay here and live in West Virginia. My mom lives here still, and both my mom and dad are still alive. Dad's going to be 78 in January. Nice. Yeah, and my mom's going to be, she's 69 now, so she'll be 70 in May. Mm-hmm. I'll be 50 in September. My son will be 20 in August. So a lot of strange numbers there, even numbers, yeah, 10 decades, you know, just 3 decades separates me and my dad, 2 between my mom, mm-hmm. 3 between me and my son. But I have a daughter, too, and she'll be 17 in June.
Does she have any interest in wrestling?
Oh, she hates it. Oh, she hates wrestling. You know, and she's a smart girl, though. My son, he likes wrestling, but he don't like wrestling. He's one of those guys that he'll do it to get a little bit of money. But if he was to go to work, he'd rather do his regular job.
Yeah.
You know, so that's how he is. My nephew loves it. If my nephew wants to do wrestling full time, so but he loves it. So it may just be my nephew. Who knows? We'll just see how it goes. I mean, I'm not going to force any of them to do anything they want to do, don't want to do, you know. Of course, they came to me. They came to me asked to be a wrestler, not me, not the other way around. I was hoping they would do something else, you know. But if that's what they want to do, then I'll be behind them 100%. My daughter, too. But whatever she wants to do, I'll always be behind her. So
yeah.
My mom hated wrestling, too, just so you know.
Great, very insightful.
Just know that wrestling in West Virginia, the boys and the girls start at the bottom. They start with nothing. They don't get really good paydays. So they're doing it for the love, and they're doing it to try to make a name, a mark, and it's a starting point. And people should go out and support local wrestling, any local thing, because even if it's a guy that's singing music, they should support it, because that person could be the next star. You don't know. You're maybe the one to help them get there. But these kids today, they're really good athletes. They are athletes, and they are very good performers. And I'm really proud of wrestling, you know, being part of it, my heritage. And I'm also proud of the people today and what they're doing. I mean, it's not necessarily my type of wrestling, but it is what it is today, and they are tremendous, because they're doing stuff I would never have done, I can't do,
mm-hmm.
and I have respect for that, you know. And anybody steps through those ropes, it's not easy. I respect anyone steps through the ropes and gives it a shot, you know. And hopefully most of them will achieve their dreams and their goals, and people from West Virginia should come out and support them.
I watched this Saturday Night Wrestling documentary, and there was a guy from Beckley, the Black Diamond.
Okay.
Is he still around?
Okay, Chief Black Eagle and Black Diamond. That's Hubert Simpson's Black Diamond. No, Hubert Simpson died some odd years ago. I did that documentary, WOY. That was done back in 1999.
Okay,
both Black Diamond and Chief Black Eagle are long dead and gone. Chief Black Eagle died back in 2005.
Okay.
Gene Madrid passed away a few years ago. Irish Pat Clancy's dead and gone.
Trying to get in touch with Shirley Love.
Yeah, Shirley Love, he still lives here in Oak Hill, is, you know. Yeah, I can give you his number too,
that'd
but his number's in the phone book.
Okay.
Under Shirley Love.
Yes.
And
I don't have a phone book anymore. Well, it might at work.
Well, yeah. You can search for it, but I'll give you his number. I got it. But Shirley's he's part of the whole heritage too. I mean, he's one of those personalities. You gotta understand, he loves wrestling, and one of his favorite, he wrote a book about it, you know, Man Called Shirley. He also talks about it. He's got a lot of memorabilia and everything from there, but he took that. Someone else was supposed to be it was the host and didn't like it, so he stepped up because he loved it. And became the whole thing until it ended. And you have personalities. Well, Shirley Love was one of those personalities. Like Stampede Wrestling had Ed Whalen. You had Lance Russell for Memphis, and you had Gordon Solie for the NWA, Vince McMahon for WWF, and you know. And Shirley Love was one of those personalities. He was one of those personalities of wrestling, you know, the signature guy of the show. So, and if it wasn't for him, I don't think silent wrestling would have been as popular, because I think the host of the show is very much as important as the wrestlers themselves. Right. So, but yeah, Shirley Love was very much a part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again.
No problem.